The BBC would like to apologize for the following announcement.
This episode of The Python Perspective is brought to you by the architecture firm of Ironside and Malone. Relax in comfort, knowing that your forever home is constructed and designed by the finest minds that nearly got in at Hendon.
Tenants arrive in the entrance hall here, are carried along the corridor on a conveyor belt in extreme comfort and past murals depicting Mediterranean scenes.
As you travel along the soundproofed corridor toward the waiting knives, enjoy the Neo-Georgian splendor and security of your imminent demise. Welcome to the Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Nathan, physicist, improv comedian, and actor.
Hello, Ben. How are you today?
I'm well. It is a fine... Well, I'm not really pretending that these are being recorded on the actual 50th anniversary of the air date anymore. That we've missed that window considerably. But it's good to talk to you and to think that we were real close to the 50th anniversary of the original broadcast of the fourth episode of Series 2, Monty Python's Flying Circus, The Buzz Aldrin Show, which originally was put on the air on BBC One on 20th of October, 1970.
The Buzz Aldrin Show.
Now, Nate, as a former person who was, you're definitely still a current person. As a person who was formerly quite focused on astrophysics, when you saw the name The Buzz Aldrin Show, did that have put a little thrill of astronaut worship down your spine? Were you disappointed that it turned out to be just a one-note joke at the end? Or is this episode something that we've all watched so many times that that memory is swept under the rug of the actual experience of remembering the individual sketches of this episode?
Well, honestly, the first thing I thought about was not this episode. Even though I was looking at the Buzz Aldrin Show, I was misremembering, and now for something completely different, where they have, this is actually the headquarters of NASA, and Buzz Aldrin, the NASA's number two spaceman, makes an appearance. If you remember that.
I'm not sure.
Kind of like weird assortment of film footage.
Huh.
Or actually, it may have been part of the Fliegender Circus.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure.
Aldrin appears prominently in one of the Fliegender Circus episodes. And that is a series of Pythonania that I'm not intimately familiar with. There's a good chance that I haven't even watched all of it, that I've dipped into it a little bit and then found it to be amusing but inessential to watch them do sketches I've already seen, which means that there's legitimately original Python material that I've still never seen, because I do know that they wrote new material for that as opposed to just recycling stuff in German language.
Yeah, what you're saying is true, but they have used that footage for the live shows.
Okay.
Only redubbed in English. So all of the Germans versus Greek soccer match, the Olympics with the people for incontinence and people think they're chickens, and that's all part of the Fliegender Circus, but was repurposed for the live at the Hollywood Bowl, for example.
Okay.
Everything was done in English.
So if I were to watch Hollywood Bowl again, some of the broadcast footage on the big screen for the audience there would have been redubbed German footage for their delectation.
That's right.
Okay. That's fun. It means that even all those diehard Monty Python fans in 1980 or whenever that was presented were actually getting to see not just live material, but new material. Probably most of them hadn't been able to have access to that footage at that time.
There was no YouTube back at that time.
Right. This is a tangent, but the Star Wars audio drama that was on NPR had lots of expanded story content in it Brian Daley worked hard to have plenty of things that were sort of rounded out. The missing footage of Luke at Anchorhead with Biggs, etc., was all given quite a well-rounded experience. And because I listened to those radio show episodes live on NPR, for years I was confused that I could have sworn I'd seen footage that was in Star Wars that wasn't in Star Wars. And it wasn't until they made those tapes and CDs commercially available years later that I finally figured out, oh, I hadn't seen it. I just heard it, and I'd made up the images in my mind. There have to have been people who were at the Hollywood Bowl who watched that footage of the German clips and then got that all tangled up in their head, where they would watch VHS of the Flying Circus episodes later and go, wait, 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 that's not how that was. And live in that weird, ambiguous Berenstain Bears universe of not understanding why their memories and reality didn't match up.
I'm sure it happens all the time. To touch on the end of your question, was I disappointed? I was surprised a little bit that Buzz Aldrin, first of all, made an appearance at all. That was actually kind of significant. Like, he actually has his visage pasted up on the screen, and he is first and foremost in the credits. I thought it may have been just a
Lunar module calling Buzz Aldrin, come in. Raindrops keep falling on my head.
And have it just be that. But no, they actually lean in pretty hard.
Similarly, the reference to Buzz Aldrin, the astronaut, was the product of a disordered mind and should not be construed as having any other significance.
But it's all right at the end.
Right.
I guess that's par for the course, because they're kind of lambasting that character as being deranged. And so pay no mind to what he says, but pay all your attention to what he has said.
Chapman's character of Police Constable Pan Am is very odd to me. I have one note on it, but mostly just a feeling of confusion that character is basically so chaotic.
Shut up! Fatang! Fatang! Oh, that's nice. Right! I'm taking you along to the station.
We've talked in previous episodes about whether or not we feel like certain elements of the show were rewritten or reconstructed, maybe on the fly, particularly when they're in studio appearances, that there may have been some editorial work being done. He is legitimately without tether in a way where the sketch truly goes off the rails, and I'm kind of fascinated by its very existence without necessarily having any real insight into it.
Do you think there's a space for such a character? I mean, it sounds like you think that the character kind of sucks all the oxygen out of the room and makes the rest of the sketch just kind of wither and die.
I hadn't thought of it, but I do think that that's not an inaccurate take on my emotions to it. So for listeners unfamiliar with this oddly named character, the very end of the episode, there has been a series of sketches that take place in a chemist's, in a pharmacist's. And the third of them has a character at the counter of the chemist. Another character comes in to begin shoplifting materials off the counter, and they call for the police. And Graham Chapman shows up as a deeply unhinged police constable.
Now then, your turn.
Aren't you going to say what's all this then?
Oh, right. What's all this then?
This man has been shoplifting, officer.
Oh, yes?
Yes.
Are you trying to tell me my job?
Who then starts randomly throwing his weight around as an officer of the law, and then the episode quickly ends. Part of the obvious charm of Monty Python is something we've mentioned again and again, that they are willing to subvert the conceits of their own episodes. And this is a radical departure from where the sketch had been going prior to that. And I think a genuine loony character can be a lot of fun. But yeah, I think he's a little like an improv artist who comes in and isn't saying yes and. He's saying splunge. He's saying things that aren't helpful to the other actors at all. That doesn't give them any room to move because he's Michael Scarning it up.
yeah. It's called a yes, yes.
Okay.
Where you agree to the premise of whatever's happening, but you don't add anything onto it. So it leaves people kind of grasping at what was said before the character came in and pulled the pin on the hand grenade, which then blew up the scene.
Yeah, I really do feel like he blows up the scene. I think that's an accurate description. It's not unfunny. It's just there's no interaction. There's no opportunity for the characters to really do anything. And so he careens and makes airplane noises and stuffs things in his shirt. And everyone's sort of dumbstruck. And it's a bravura moment for Chapman, but it does totally destroy the integrity of the scene.
Unlike, for example, season one, episode whatever, with Brian Equator, with he and his wife, who are quite uncouth and loud and very disruptive to the evening that Graham and Carol Cleveland are having. If you remember back to that episode, that scene was written and designed for everything that was normal to be derailed.
I also think a little bit of Graham's character of the judge from earlier in this series, where he's going on about how he's going to South Africa because then he can get some real executions done. It has that similar kind of, I'm going to go on for a little bit and I'm going to drop some non sequiturs in from what's going on. But it comes back around by the way in which he sentences Terry Jones's judge to death. Whereas this, he just grabs Eric Idle's character and Frog marches him out of the room and everyone else is sort of left there being like, what just happened?
Yeah.
Including the BBC, which is why they have to say, excuse me, we're very sorry.
The BBC would like to apologize to the police about the character of Police Constable Pan Am.
This is our fourth apology during this episode, but we're going to apologize once again and we want to make sure that we haven't ruffled any feathers here.
What I do remember when you were talking about Graham Chapman as the judge who was going to get his cat of nine tails and executions per month in South Africa, you felt that sketch was kind of hastily, it felt hastily put together.
Yeah, I felt like there was some issues there in terms of the tightness of the script.
Okay, so what's your contention here? Do you think it was assembled in the same way or they had this printed on the script from the first final copy and just went with it, and it just doesn't translate as well for you 50 years later.
I don't have any indication that this feels like it was being done on the spot. There's nothing about the language or the come-in that feels accidental. It just feels like a very strange power grab. How much is Graham in the rest of the episode?
Well, he's in all of the Gumbies, of course. He's in the architect sketch.
He is. He's the straight man in the architect sketch.
He's the straight man, as labeled so, in the insurance sketch.
Maybe that's it. If I was to put a thesis out there without having necessarily gathered evidence to support it, my first instinct would be that Graham played too many straight, ordinary people in this episode and hadn't had a chance to really go nuts, to be really funny. And so that character was potentially designed around the opportunity to give him someplace really nutso to go. And I think he grabs it with both hands. But at the same time, it happens in such an extreme way in relationship to what has been going on in the sketch prior to that.
Okay. I wouldn't say definitely. His straight characters were not unfunny.
Mm-hmm.
They just weren't silly.
Yes.
There was the audio you played between Stephen Colbert and John Cleese a while back that seemed to indicate that there is a mistranslation of the word stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Americans thought stupid. John Cleese reinterpreted as silly.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe stupid silly is kind of that zany character like Police Constable Pan Am, whereas the straight man is the opposite of that. But the straight man definitely has some humoristic pops. Like, he definitely gets some funny laughs.
Excuse me, do I have any more lines?
Oh, don't know, Mush. I'll have a look in your script. Where are we? Show 8. Are you man?
Yeah,
man.
But he doesn't do anything wild in and of himself. And so, yeah, that is the gem of the thrust of my current interpretation and reaction to that scene, is that it may have been Graham saying, I want to do something nutsy and zany in this episode at some point, because he hadn't really been given a chance to do anything so surreal prior to that. And he does it with absolute aplomb.
Since this character has come up in previous episodes, do you think that may have been a quick get-out-of-show-free card? Look, guys, you only got 30 seconds left in the episode. What are we going to do? Well, we can't have Terry make another cartoon because he's already done, you know, a good 4 minutes of cartoon this episode. So he's kind of flat out. Let's end it on this Buzz Aldrin line from Pan Am, because he can pretty much do anything.
I mean, and I like the credits. I like the idea that the part of the running structure of the episode is there are two. The first is the Gumbies introducing things. But the other is the introduction to the Gumbies is the BBC apologizing.
The BBC would like to apologize for the next announcement.
This is a heavy subtitle and green display over episode. They use that burn-in technique a lot. And I think it works very well as a breaking the fourth wall television about television episode. And so I like it as a conclusion. I like the fact that it leads into credits by Buzz Aldrin and the BBC apologizing. Mm-hmm. So you need something. You need some kind of escalation to get the BBC to be needing to cover its tracks. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so you like how the apologies start and end the episode.
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, I can get on board with that. Rather than just a haphazard, we need something.
Right.
That would not be in the Python tradition where they almost to a point of obsession have like everything planned out at the script writing portion of the show's creation. Well, since you mentioned it, I'm going to lead in with my first favorite sketch is each of the incarnations of the Gumbies.
The Gumbies are an interestingly potentially polarizing group of characters because they're kind of hard to understand, because they're a certain brand of on-your-face stupidity. I still think Gumby flower arranging, it might be a work of genius that should be celebrated and added into canon of anything. So I love the Gumbies showing up. I don't know, maybe I had you pegged wrong, but I sort of thought that you weren't a Gumbies fan.
Let me preempt, I guess, what I was. I think this episode is so good. There are so many good things in it. I pick up the Gumbies because they happen so many times.
Yeah.
And they also are not just themselves and they're done. They interact with the players of the first scene. I don't know if they do that for the next scenes, but definitely for the architect sketch.
Gentlemen, we have two basic suggestions for the design of this. Shut up! Gentlemen, we have two basic suggestions.
And then getting dumped on with water is hilarious.
It really is.
It's simple, lowbrow humor just to have these stupid characters who mean well and are trying to do a good job. But all the same, they suck at it. it percolated to the top of my list, so that's why I put it there. I do think lots of the sketches were very good and could easily top any list, but when pushed to choose three, that was one of them.
I think this is perhaps the first, I was about to say this is perhaps the first episode of the second series that feels like classic first series Python. Because structurally, it's got vox pops in the middle. It's got short sketches.
I wonder what other people use for aftershave lotion.
I use a body rub called halitosis.
But we began this series by me saying that episode one of series two is kind of a structural recap of episode one, series one. So I think I can't really make that claim that this is the first return to form. But the fact that there are even callbacks, that the Gumbies are a callback, that you have Ken Shabby show up, that you have the two Spanish Inquisition callbacks.
I use two kinds of aftershave lotion. Frankincense, myrrh, three kinds of aftershave lotion.
That it feels very much like, again, Python creating its own crazy tack board of yarn going from thing to thing, of them starting to create an enmeshed in reference universe for fans.
And also Parrot.
You haven't got anything a little more halibutish? Parrot? What's that doing there?
Indeed.
That's interesting. If they're, is it like a self-congratulatory, almost victory lap? Hey, look, we made it to series two and we're doing a good job.
Well, I will say that during the Vox Pops, when Cardinal Richelieu shows up, there is a shriek of laughter from the audience. There is some woman in the audience who is so excited to see this character again. So I don't think it's just for themselves. I think they're beginning to be aware of the fact that that kind of self-referential universe creation is part of what people are looking for. Or at least that kind of reaction would create further inclination to do so.
A parallel question. In the Living on the Pavement sketch, which does not make it into my top three, you have Michael Palin and Graham Chapman living on the street inside a essentially home without walls, just on the sidewalk.
Right.
Oh, it's nice to be home.
Builders haven't been there.
These two old people are typical of the housing problem.
In front of a theater with the marquee advertising Peter Sellers in the movie Hoffman, which I have not seen. But the fact that it's Peter Sellers, isn't it funny that they're playing homeless people outside of a more successful version of themselves?
Right. I'm trying to remember the timeline precisely. No. It was Michael Rimmer that had come out right around this time. And that was a Cook and Moore production. Their work on The Magic Christian, I don't have the dates in my head, and I'm not going to spend time looking it up. But yeah, their work with Sellers on Magic Christian, writing and doing bit parts in that, I feel like was in the previous year. I think anybody would have been envious to a degree of Sellers' success. And I think that that was just a lucky opportunity to point out, hey, remember this guy who we all loved on The Goon Show? Yeah, he's doing well, isn't he?
What else can we say about the Gumbies? I mean, we've talked about them in previous episodes, but just some simple points. That I do like how they had even brought the Gumbies down a notch when in season one, the first time you see them is, I think it's John Cleese, who, instead of being a dim-witted commoner, he's kind of like a little rednecky racist guy who's extremely xenophobic.
Right, the Enoch Powell reference.
Yeah, they've dialed that down to just, it's a person with a body and some kind of mind, a handkerchief, mustache, and a stupid sweater vest who can do very little. I love the simplicity.
Well, I'll say this in case this doesn't come up later. This is the episode where magically the Gumbies are suddenly turned into female Gumbies.
And now for something completely different.
And we have a couple of returning guest stars playing the parts of the five pythons.
Oh, yeah.
The women who play the five female Gumbies are Beulah Hughes, Marie Flanagan, Barbara Lindley, and Sandra Richards. And Sandra Richards appears three or four times in this particular episode. But Flanagan had been the coat check girl and bikini model in previous episodes. And Beulah Hughes had also played the nurse during the removal of the squatters in the untitled episode 13 in series one. So it was an opportunity to, you know, invite a couple of day players back for a tiny little scene. And I kind of like that while we're talking about intra-Python continuity.
My second favorite sketch leads in from the first Gumby appearance is the architect sketch.
The architect sketch is so good.
We wanted a simple block of flats.
Ah, I see. I hadn't correctly divined your attitude towards your tenants. You see, I mainly design slaughterhouses.
It's so good. I am a little bit biased because this is one of the sketches I would listen to on audio only throughout college. Mm. And so I remember that first and foremost over other sketches. It has so many, like, when we talk about good elements, we talk about Cleese being just like over the top maniacal.
You excrement! You lousy, hypocritical, whining toadies! With your lousy color TV sets and your Tony Jets and golf clubs!
Definitely the sort of absurdist situations, and this, that being the link up from the Gumby portion of the sketch.
From the Gumbies in the first place, yes.
The overlay of text on the screen to sort of indicate this is what the production is thinking, but this is not necessarily what you're hearing. It has a lot of great elements. It has also, on top of that, some special effects which are not quite as common, but also very effective.
I believe in a previous episode we talked about the ability to have dynamic explosions without risking the actors. And when Eric Idle's block of flats explodes, first of all, it's so bright, it basically blows out the videotape from in studio, which is impressive. But also that it's impressive that they got that mini explosion right in the tower that he's next to. If you watch his hands, Idle fidgets nervously with the model of the block of flats. And I watched it very carefully because I wasn't sure if maybe he was the person that was pulling the trigger on the explosion. Now that I talk about it, my suspicion is that he may have done this once before and it may have not gone quite so well. Like, I think he's, I think he might be a little bit nervous about the fact that this thing in front of him is about to catch fire.
He does. So the model does a couple of things before it explodes, right? It actually tips over and you can see his right hand is like pulling at some switch.
Mm.
And at some point, some of the central floors just sort of fall out of place.
Mm-hmm.
And his left hand, which is then on top of the skyscraper, is actually pressing a button. You can see him do that.
Oh, interesting.
Although he's pointing to a road, so he's kind of misdirecting you. His axis would be from Dvingli Road, and he presses a button with his left hand.
The dividing walls on each floor section are fixed with recessed magnesium flange group.
But when it comes to the fire and the explosion, I think he's like taking a couple steps back. So I think that might be a off-camera pyrotechnician doing that. But, you know, it could be that he's tried this before and like, well, I don't want to do that again.
Right. I'm sure there's a lot of timing involved. If they were able to do this more than once, and let's point out that that kind of a model would have been expensive to have been made and exploded and have another one go by. So that nervousness could have just been chalked up to the fact that they had one go at this and the timing had to be perfect. And that could have been anxiety inducing in an actor enough. Or he could have been acting. He could have been playing a person who didn't have a strong sense that he was going to win until he was able to whip out the Masonic handshake and show that that's all that he really needed to get the contract.
I think this also has one of the greatest high SAT word rants.
From Cleese?
From Cleese.
It's just that we wanted a block of flats and not an abattoir.
Yes, but of course that's just the sort of blinkered Philistine pig ignorance I've come to expect. Creative garbage.
I've attributed expansion to my personal vocabulary from Python. This is one of those sketches that does it. Words like purulent, Philistine, blinkered, abattoir. It's like if you want to learn more about the English language in a fun way, this is a great way to do it.
Yeah. If you want to have a small clutch of negative pointed words that aren't actually vulgar, so if you want to get away with insulting somebody in a PG-rated way, this rant is a great toolbox for that. Cleese didn't have a whole heck of a lot to do in the previous episode, and so this is a great showcase for him. He really throws himself into it. On the HD, he's scarlet with the effort of getting frustrated and angry and shouting, and he's great at it.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I enjoy this sketch so much, is that he is that character.
Mm-hmm.
But then on top of that, he switches from that aggressive Cleese to the more meek, subordinate Cleese, which we don't often see, but that transition is nice to continue along and not just burn out.
But if one of you could put in a word for me, I'd love to be a Freemason. Freemasonry opens doors. I mean, I was a bit on edge just now, but if I was a Mason, I'd just sit at the back and not get in anyone's way.
And it gives us the, speaking of television appropriate euphemisms, it gives us the abattoir.
Nice though the abattoir is. the abattoir, that's not important.
Which is a pretty great substitution for anybody who needs to swear and is unable to. Just throw in an abrupt mini raspberry for whatever word you were about to say and self-censor appropriately.
So as I mentioned, I did used to listen to the audio form of this sketch, or just the audio, in college. So I clearly was not able to hear the word satire being put up on the screen.
Right.
Even though it does feel kind of zany, it's interesting to see now that there is satire, not just on the screen, but sort of blinking, like, you know, a blinking yellow hazard light. But it turns out that there were some ineffective architecture disasters in London. Mm-hmm. So something called the Ronan Point disaster, a tower that collapsed in 1968 where four people died, is supposedly linked to, or that's the nexus for this particular sketch. I don't know, maybe your sources will tell you a little bit more about it and you can talk something about it.
I can't talk about that specific reference. I will say that a number of sources link this to dear old friend Reginald Maudling, who was also connected with a corrupt architect, John Polson. And Polson was involved in a number of kickbacks and contracts where he specifically granted things to Masons instead of going through the proper channels. And good old, lovely old Home Secretary Reggie Maudling was linked to that. And Polson, I believe, was imprisoned or fined heavily in 1972. But people are aware in the sort of rumor department about this kind of infelicity already at this time.
Okay.
So
definitely
a thing. And I'll also say that this has unfortunately long legs in terms of relevance. In 2017, there was a terrible fire in a block of flats in London, the Grenfell Tower fire. And I don't wish to make light of this at all, but I think that a block of flats in a large tower that catches fire and explodes, and then has people say,
"After all, they're not meant to be luxury flats."
No, I quite agree. I mean, provided the tenants are of light build and relatively sedentary, and given a spot of good weather, I think we're on to a winner, yeah?
Is terrible. And I think that there are probably people who are in London now who couldn't watch this sketch without it being legitimately triggering at that kind of callousness. 72 people died as a result of the Grenfell Tower fire, and I think that this is a very funny sketch, and I think there are probably some people who, even though it's 50 years old, would find it to be in bad taste.
I understand. All right, third favorite sketch. The Bishop.
Okay, Devious, don't move.
The Bishop!
Oh, Nathan, I'm so glad you chose this sketch. I think when I first had the opportunity to watch Monty Python, this was one of the high points of that experience. Like, I think I was a giggling teenager of a nutcase when I finally got a chance to watch this sketch live. That I'd read the script and I thought that it was hilarious, and to see it in real life was everything I could have possibly hoped for. And when it comes down to it, it's actually not that funny of a sketch, but that theme music and that title sequence and the fact that it's a time loop, callbacks plus really good animation, I'm willing to forgive a lot because of that.
It has a lot of elements that are we've talked of before, like sped-up film. And somewhere in there, there's a jab at Scotland by one of the characters being the moderator of the Church of Scotland. Other credits, including somebody who plays the voice of God, there's some prebendary. These are things that have come up before. But the sped-up film definitely makes an appearance a couple times.
It does, including when we're about to close the first loop and you've got the bishop and his absolute stone-cold thugs of ministers walking alongside him, priests walking alongside him, pushing people out of the way to the tune of Henry Mancini's Peter Gunn theme. And the soundtrack itself speeds up along with them in order to make it even funnier. I think the title sequence is masterful. I think Gilliam absolutely outdid himself with the design of it. The audience laughs like crazy when that first theme happens. Speaking of things that we might not have appreciated, It turns out that the theme that they use is the theme to a television show called The Informer, which was on from 66 to 67. And so I think some people must have been laughing not just at the design, but at the theme song, being like, oh my God, I recognize that theme. This is a funny reclaiming, repurposing of it.
Yeah, I could see that.
But then they laugh just as hard when it comes back the second time because, yeah, it's a pretty great theme. And the fact that they're literally showing it to us all over again the second time. We've talked a lot this series about timing and the use of the real estate of the half an hour that they have. The fact that they're like, yeah, we're gonna show you the whole theme again is wonderful.
I wonder if they were doing that kind of in an in-the-moment kind of feel, because they got such a response the first time it happened. Like, oh, well, we could just play it a second time.
No idea, but it sure did produce a very voluble audience response.
Oh, yeah.
And Terry Jones's butch semi-Chicago impression that he does in order to be depressed that we are too late.
Don't say the kid's name, Vic!
Francesco Luigi.
We was too late. The Reverend Nuke saw the light.
Yeah, it really doesn't hang together as a sketch. It's just a series of vague liturgical references and people dying and then him not getting there in time.
Not getting there in time and getting there increasingly late. Don't touch the ring!
Yeah, that part of it is the weak part, but it's made great by Jones's performance. He commits to the bit, even though the joke itself is just four different things of people dying in religious settings. Although, the cannon coming out of the gravesite is basically a live-action Terry Gilliam cartoon, and I'm here for it.
Also, the thumping of the desk with the staff, it comes a little bit out of left field to the point where it jerks you awake from the sort of dialogue that was happening just before. And the looking straight at the camera of Palin as Mr. Devia saying, "Oh, the bishop!" And then the launching into that music. It's well choreographed. Very well conceived.
Speaking of callbacks and this sketch, why isn't Palin playing Luigi Vercotti?
In any form or
in this one particular of the sketch. In the insurance sketch, he's playing a gruff, slimy mobster who's interested in porn and is trying to cheat people. Basically, if he'd had a slightly different wig and put on sunglasses, he could have been Luigi Vercotti. But instead, he's playing Mr. Devious. And it interests me that they went to the well of repeating themselves, of calling back old characters several times in this episode, but they didn't there when really the difference between Mr. Devious and Luigi Vercotti is a hair color, and that's about it.
Actually, I disagree with that. I think Mr. Devious...
Good. This is why I asked.
Mr. Devious has a very tight economy on words. He will not even complete words. He just kind of says them in that, I'm not sure it's Cockney, but that sort of slurred English shorthand where everything kind of becomes one word of a full sentence.
Look, Rev, I hate to see a man cry, so shove off out of the office, that's a good thing.
Where I feel like Vercotti tends to run on a lot and say things he really ought not to be saying, but just kind of says them because he's a little bit of a nervous person.
Yeah,
we are not a cheap club where guys pick up tarts. It's not we forbid that entirely. Don't call the police. That kind of extra anxious energy, which adds on to the length of that, increases the amount of time you have to listen to him talk. Where as Devious is just like, all right, shove out the office, all right, goodbye. He's very brief and what's the word I'm looking for?
Succinct,
maybe terse, if that works.
On the other hand, he doesn't really know what he's doing. I mean, he's lucky enough to have successfully gotten the vicar to sign the no-claim contract.
It states quite clearly that no claim you make will be paid. You see,
You unfortunately plumped for our never pay policy, which, you know, if you never claim, is very worthwhile.
But at the same time, previously, with Graham Chapman's straight man, who just needs a quote on his Aston Martin, he has no idea what a good policy would be. He starts off with a 500 quid down payment and then a 40 quid and then a nude lady or just some smut. He has no idea what the proper terms should be. And it leans into that same kind of nervous, I'm making this up as I'm going along quality.
True. It is true. It just seems like they wanted a character who you could believe would just reach into a vault full of papers, find his jacket, and pull out the policy on a greasy, folded piece of paper. It doesn't really seem like a Vercati move.
No, you're very right about that.
He's a little more crisp and slick, but devious, this little one-off character. He just kind of presents himself to the world as being a kind of a slug.
Yeah, he's not good at his job because he's not good at his job, whereas Luigi Vercati is not good at his job because he's in over his head in a different kind of way. He's the kind of person that offers a protection racket to the army because he's biting off more than he can chew. But he's still putting a brave face on it, whereas Devious has just happened to get lucky with this one vicar.
I enjoy Devious as a character. Had it been Vercati, I don't know if I would have been wishing it were somebody who was not Vercati, but trying to put an explanation as to why it was not Vercati since you asked the question, it just seems like Devious, he's just kind of a lech, you know. He just happened to get this job and barely hangs on to it. Always hoping, thinking that, you know, the ace in the pocket is a nude lady.
So we now have a totally new offer.
What's that?
A nude lady.
Nude lady?
Yes, you get a nude lady with a fully comprehensive motor insurance. If you just want third party, she has to keep her bra on. And if it's just theft, then
no,
it's
no, 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 I don't really want that.
I can sell you a nude lady. Like, why wouldn't you want that?
Why wouldn't you want that? You're a straight man, for God's sakes. All right, I think that brings us to the Monty Python Minute. Monty Python Minute is when I have used the good folks at random.org to produce a random number between 1 and 29 in a 29-minute, 56-second episode. We will then fast-forward to that minute. Nate will watch the minute, and then he will have 30 seconds to summarize what takes place during those 60 seconds. If he's successful, he goes on to the quiz with a bonus point. If he's unsuccessful, he starts off on an even playing field to try and get a majority of the five questions correct. Nathan, are you ready to find out what random.org has chosen for your little slice of narrative today?
I'm ready.
The randomly selected minute is minute number 24. That's minute 24.
Last time it was 25.
And the time before that, it was 24. I'm beginning to doubt the good people at random.org.
How about something a little more musky? This one's called Nimmo.
Not really, no. Have you anything a little fishier?
Fishier?
Fishier.
Fish, fish, fish. A fishy requisite.
All right. Nathan, your 30 seconds begin now.
Eric Idle's in a chemist shop who is behind the counter is Michael Palin, and Eric Idle's asking for some aftershave, and Michael Palin offers Nimmo for its more muskiness, but Eric Idle would like something that's a little more fishy, and a fishy requisite, and they list off a bunch of flavors of fish in the sea that could possibly satisfy, including halibut, sea bass, hake, prawn, skate, or parrot.
5 seconds left.
Parrot gets him to look, and the crab, tiger, and almonds is what they want, and then Michael Palin goes off to get it from the depot.
Time!
Or from downstairs.
So close. So close.
Oh, the 30 seconds. All right.
Yes, the not-at-all naughty chemists after the not-so... Naughty chemist after the naughty chemist. The requisite, I know, is speaking of things that you have incorporated into your own vocabulary before. I feel like that extended percussive T sound is something that you have busted out on occasion.
Yes, it is. It is.
Well, I spent a reasonable amount of time on Wikipedia looking at the phonetics section to try and understand sounds and phonemes to be able to quiz you about the fricative T's, except they're not fricatives. They're not. I literally could not understand it. I thought about calling up a friend who studied linguistics and decided, no, actually, We're going to do a quiz about fish.
Okay. Very good.
Theirs is the list of different ingredients and flavors of toilet waters of eau de toilette that is listed by Palin in the sketch. Halibut, sea bass, bream, mackerel, cod, hake, parrot, skate, prawn, crab, tiger, and almonds. And those are all the answers that you will have available to you in the next five questions.
All right.
So, question number one.
Oh, God.
Which of the following fish has a name that is derived from its popularity as a fish that could be eaten on fasting days if you are Catholic? A, halibut. B, sea bass. Or C, bream.
I choose C, bream.
Unfortunately, halibut is derived from holy butt, butt being a kind of flat fish. And so the halibut was able to be eaten on days when you were not allowed to consume flesh, flesh being warm-blooded animals, and fish didn't count.
Okay.
Nate, if you'd thought hard, you would have chosen that answer out of thousands, because the others were all too flat.
Very good.
Question number two. Spain consumes an enormous amount of this fish, purchasing 50% of the supply for all of Europe. In fact, the average person in Spain consumes 13 pounds of this fish each year. Is it A, mackerel, B, cod, or C, hake?
And I'm going to go with C, hake.
Correct.
Whew.
Question number three. Basically, these three organisms are very dissimilar. The parrotfish sleeps in a slime cloud to dissuade predators. The skate produces electricity, and the prawn is a crustacean. So, it's difficult to find things in common between them. However, only two of these three swim due to pectoral locomotion. Which does not? A, parrotfish. B, skate. Or C, prawn.
Well, part of me wants to use skate as a verb, but because I feel like fish swim as fish and crustaceans are different anatomically, I'm going to say prawn.
Correct.
All right.
The prawn's front legs are called pteropods, and they're used for walking. It's the rear abdominal legs, or pleopods, that are for swimming.
Yeah, these boots are made for walking.
Well, they can walk all over me. Question number four. According to an article on the BBC from July, which organism are we milking to help develop a coronavirus vaccine? A, crab, B, tigers, or C, almonds?
I know almond milk is a thing, but somehow I don't seem to think that's the right thing. I'm going to say crab.
Correct.
All right.
Horseshoe crab blood is used to detect bacteria and other impurities in newly created medicines and drugs. And we have been bleeding or milking horseshoe crabs for their blood in order to detect impurities for years. A synthetic solution was created in 2016, but the sheer amount of effort to create the coronavirus vaccine has required some labs to go back to milking crabs for their blood.
You know, I learned on the show Cosmos that at one point in the past, horseshoe crabs were the dominant species on the Earth.
Yeah, well, if their blood is totally able to eradicate impurities and bacteria, that would make a certain degree of sense.
All right.
For your final question, Nathan.
Oh, boy.
According to SushiModern.com, which of the following contains no risk for parasites when eaten raw? A, sea bass. B, bream. C, mackerel. D, cod. Or E, hake.
Sea bass.
Unfortunately, two kinds of sea bass, Chilean sea bass and a second one I've forgotten, are both at risk for parasites when eaten raw, as are all of the others except bream.
Bream.
So that means you got 3 out of 5 correct. So you are a winner.
Yeehaw. I am, and you're a witness.
That's right. I sort of assumed you'd get the sushi one. I don't know why. I think of you as a sushi person.
Yes, but I don't know what I eat, so who cares? Plus, I mean, halibut, I think, is on the sushi menu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, frequently the others, they are.
All I really know about any of those, with the exception of prawn and crab, is that mackerel is usually eaten in the Turkey, like Black Sea area of Europe, and it's a smelly fish. That's all I know.
So it would make sense that, therefore, it would be one of the fishy fishes that Eric Idle's character was looking for.
And he should have asked for that specifically. All right, now we're going to move on to our top five moments. A top moment, of course, is something which is not necessarily a full sketch, though it could be. But it needn't be, only needs to be a small bit of line delivery or acting or gesture or cartoon, which just makes us chortle. So, Ben, would you please start us off with a top five moment?
Nathan, it would be remiss of me if I didn't threaten to get kicked off my own podcast by saying the word Semprini!
Out!
There are a couple of really solid jokes in the censored words sketch.
The BBC would like to apologize for the poor quality of the writing in that sketch. It is not BBC policy to get easy laughs with words like bum, knickers, botty, or wee-wees.
The obvious one being that if you remove the vowel, knickers and knockers look exactly the same. But I didn't get that Semprini was a person. I don't know if that necessarily matters. I'm not sure they were specifically satirizing the Semprini Serenade radio show that went on for years on BBC Two. Alberto Semprini doing his very British piano music with his weird... Are you interested in hearing the introduction of the Semprini Serenade?
Well, if you have it, please do.
Hey, listen to this.
Hello. Old ones, new ones, loved ones, neglected ones.
I mean, you can sort of picture Pepper Potts the world over swooning at that voice and those delicate fingers. His radio show lasted forever, and I have no idea if they were deliberately saying, this is a man who should be censored because he is the height of cheese. To me, it's just a nonsense word, and that's all I take it as.
Right, who's got a boil on his Semprini then?
I take it as madcap zany ridiculousness that would be a swear word. It's much in the way that Douglas Adams uses the word Belgium as the worst swear word in the galaxy in Life, the Universe, and Everything. It's just silliness, and therefore it has long been my favorite fake swear. And the fact that somebody could innocently say it and like poor old Sandra Richards does and gets immediately kicked out of the scene.
Really?
Ouch!
Is one of my favorite things ever.
I mean, they could have put modeling on there.
Definitely could have. Wouldn't have at all been surprised. It would have been very pointed. But Semprini is funnier and more power to it.
I like that one. Again, like the sketches, there are a lot of great moments in this entire episode. As you've brought up already, I like to use, or at least say that I would use, some Monty Python lines in my everyday life. Definitely.
Look, I must warn you that anything you may say will be ignored.
Is a great line and is one of my top five moments.
Yeah, it is another example of things having unexpected resonance today, and Police Constable Pan Am abusing his police power and telling people that...
I'm taking you along to the station.
What for?
I'm charging you with illegal possession of whatever we happen to have down there.
And that whatever they say will be ignored. Yeah, defund the police. It is not at all surprising. It's only funny if you can get away with it not being used against you. But you're right. In more peaceable, privileged times, it's a very funny line.
I mean, I'm so used to the Miranda rights that anything you say will be used against you, but anything you say will be ignored. Almost has like the opposite take, where you can say whatever you want and we're not going to pay attention to it. So we're being derelict of duty as being police officers who are respectful and responsible to our own limitations.
Or alternatively, they're being accurate about it in the first place, that they have their own preconception of what your guilt or innocence is. And so whatever you say is irrelevant.
Either or. Buzz Aldrin, everybody. Okay. Ben, give us a third moment, please.
Going all the way back to the architecture sketch at the beginning of the episode, I love the way in which the transition from Cleese describing this block of flats to it being an abattoir takes place, where he talks about the comfort and the murals, and then as they're being put on a conveyor belt towards the rotating knives. And a couple of sentences later, he's interrupted.
Excuse me. Did you say knives?
And Cleese, as architect and designer, feels important to say,
Rotating knives, yes.
Like, that's the part he wants you to come away with. Don't forget the design here. This is elegant and clean in its murderificness. And those knives are not just stationary on a wall for you to be impaled in. This is no sad Aztec Indiana Jones death trap. No, no, no. Rotating knives.
Mind you, this is a real beaut. I mean, none of your blood caked on the walls and flesh flying out of the windows inconveniencing passers-by with this one. I mean, my life has been building up to this.
Okay, so for a slight shake-up of format, Nate is going to take the last two. These have both been talked about, both these sketches, so there's nothing, we're not really breaking any new ground here, so we don't need to go on length about them, but Mr. Devious's line of, well, unfortunately, you plumb for a never pay policy, which is very worthwhile if you never have to claim.
But you had to climb, and whoa, there it is.
Oh, dear, oh, dear.
Still, never mind, could be worse. How's the nude lady?
Oh, she's fine.
Just the whole worthlessness of that whole vicar going through that. I just love that delivery. This is not very eloquent, but just a few seconds of that exchange of like, well, unfortunately, your insurance policy is great unless you actually need to use it.
Right.
Which sometimes is how I feel about the American healthcare system. But aside from that,
it's generally how I feel about insurance. They want you to pay into it and they get real mad when you want to get something back out of it.
that's right.
How dare you?
Yeah.
How dare you put all this money into our pockets and then ask us to use it for you? Ugh.
But for me, why this is a good moment is less so the politically heightened awareness of it, but just merely the delivery of Devious.
Yes.
His sliminess. I love that.
All right. So I had a bet that one of your five favorite moments was going to be a particular moment in the Less Naughty Chemist sketch. And I want to see if I'm right.
Well, I can tell you are right about the sketch. Mm. It takes place probably moments after the end of minute 24. It's him saying,
actually, what happens is he just goes off there, off camera, and just waits there so it looks as though he's gone down to the basement. Actually, I think he's rather overdoing it.
Ah! Forcing Michael Palin to kind of come off of his just like sitting there, sipping a cup of tea stance, like, oh, gotta get back on screen.
It forces the camera person to cut back to Palin so that we see him and another camera person behind him, and the large blackness of the offstage area is truly, I mean, I love any behind the scenes stuff. I'm gonna forget it now. It's the Hermits scene, I think, where we have the other aspect of peeking behind the curtain of them being filmed, and we get to see the crew filming the crew filming the crew.
Ah, right.
Any kind of that, we get to peek behind the curtain of the filmmaking aspects of things is, I don't know why that's fun for me, but it always makes me a little bit happy when you get to see crew members on camera.
There's a great scene from Spaceballs where this comes up.
Yes!
Where Dark Helmet and
Lone Star
are having their quasi-lightsaber duel, and they mistakenly slice through one of the grips. And so Dark Helmet kind of sheepishly says, he did it.
Right. Because he's a villain. He's not going to take responsibility for his actions.
Same thing.
Yeah. Well, I will say I didn't anticipate that to be our action based on how strongly you in a previous episode pointed out how much you liked Stanley Mason's delivery during the gas cooker sketch. Mm-hmm. I had assumed that one of your five moments was going to be Stanley Mason popping out from inside Terry Gilliam's coat.
He's a shoplifter.
No, I'm not. He's not. I'm a witness.
Was going to be what you chose.
It is a moment, just not in the top five for me.
Fair enough. Sorry, Stanley. Better luck next time.
You made it once, Stanley. Not a second time. Plus, he is a Mason. We already talked about how weird the Masons are.
It's true. What kind of a strange garter belt handshake is he doing to Gilliam underneath that trench coat?
This Python Perspective sub-episode of Farced Perspective was conceived, researched, and performed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. Sound design also by the two of us.
The theme song is by John Philip Sousa and sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community.
Editing of this episode was done mostly by Ben. You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @farstnamebasis. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the context and lasting power of comedy. In this case, the comic phenomenon known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
If there are things, dates, facts, names, data, or phonemes, or fish of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website and we'll post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Nathan. My co-host is Ben.
Who's got wind?
We'll see you next time when we discuss episode 5, live from the Grill-O-Mat Snack Bar.